I'm looking for the one with Seymour Hersh because it's a policy and press hall event. So shouldn't we be talking about the Nord Stream since that's the biggest story of the century? And you guys, you know,
I'm sorry.
I mean, you have the executive editor of the New York Times there who came out with a phony story to try and block Seymour Hersh. It's just kind of funny how that happened, you know? I mean, did you even acknowledge Seymour Hersh? All of you are executive editors of papers that broke Pentagon, My Lai, Watergate. Is this the same papers or not? I mean, is there anything you've gotten right in the last 20 years, or am I mistaken about that? I mean, it's just kind of funny because Iraq, wrong. Syria, wrong. Russiagate, really wrong. Okay, I mean, the list goes on and on. So the last thing you could do to try and actually fix your reputation is acknowledge that through leaks, we had to find out that Zelensky was going to bomb Moscow on the anniversary. I mean, if you're so impartial, shouldn't you at least say, right, that Zelensky was going to bring us on the verge of World War III? That seems pretty fair. While Julian Assange rots in prison, all of you got, you know, fat checks because he's in jail for doing your job. And you know what? Tucker Carlson ain't no Seymour Hersh, but he did something you guys are scared to do, speak the truth, and actually be critical of the war, which is why he was actually fired from Fox, because you are all cowards, every single one of you. None of you have actually had any relevancy. And you know what? The mainstream press is now dying. Nobody's ever going to listen to you again. You have no credibility with the public. The only people who care about what you have to say are elite assholes who have nothing productive to say anymore. And it's dying off. So will you at least say something, either about Nord Stream or Ukraine or the fact that Zelensky brought us to the verge of World War III and the only reason we knew about that was through leaks? Go ahead. It's a free speech event, right? You guys are the press. Let's say something here. Mr. Khan, come on. You know, you're the executive editor of the New York Times, you know? I'm just trying to get into some good trouble here, man. Woo. Listen, Karen, get out of my face for a second. I got to talk to these gentlemen. Okay. Well, I just want to hear what they have to say. Go ahead. I'm done.
Wait your turn.
You're not going to talk to you. Come.
Wait your turn.
You could project if we can.
I would just say I think it's important to hear everybody's point of view.
Yeah.
So thank you.
All right.
I do think that we need to give our moderator a chance to ask other questions.
We're on the verge of World War III. Say something about this bombing. We blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. Listen, don't stand there while there are people rotting in prison. Nobody said anything about Uhuru, right? The socialists who are in jail for being critical of this war? God damn it!
Let's go.
At least say something about the people in jail for being critical of this war. They don't deserve to be in prison right now.
Welcome to UK Column. So that was Jose Vega from New York. Well, I'm very pleased that Jose is with me now. Welcome to the program, Jose. That was a fantastic little piece of video. And of course, there are other examples of the same type of intervention with various types of people. This isn't something we see very often over here in the UK. Maybe we need to see much more of it, but tell us what inspires you to do these interventions.
Yeah, well, Mike, thank you for showing the interventions and thank you for having me on. You're always on our shows and now I get to be on your show, so I'm happy about that. What inspired me to do these interventions is the fact that I think the world is starving for truth, and rather than waiting for somebody else to start telling it, I want to tell it. I want to be the one to tell it, and that's why I've decided to stand up and start telling the truth, and that's why these interventions have resonated around the world. I mean, the intervention that you showed, you know, I think was translated like by 7-8 different languages or so, and then I get those sent back to me, you know, and then they appear in like Telegram channels and Russian Telegram channels and Chinese social media. Italian, French, Spanish. I mean, it's absolutely crazy, but I'm happy about the response that I get. And yeah, ultimately, I just didn't want to wait for somebody to start telling the truth. So I decided to start telling it myself.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Now, you are, I believe, in New York. You've decided to stand for Congress. Now, of course, you're affiliated with Schiller Institute and LaRouche Organization and so on, but is that what has inspired you to stand? You're standing alongside Diane Sayre, of course, who's standing for the Senate. Is it the activism that's inspired you to stand, or are you taking the opportunity to campaign because the election is happening?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I get asked this a lot as to like why I decided to actually run. I mean, I know I had someone who was disappointed who said, you know, I wish you would keep the activism going. Truth is, somebody has to emulate and show people what a real congressman can be, what a real politician can actually be. And my opponent is just completely disgusting. You know, I saw something in the New York Post, I think it was, that they did a statistic that he actually mentions Israel 236% more times than he does his own district or the Bronx as a whole, right? And meanwhile, the district that I'm in is the poorest congressional district in the entire country, the entire country. It's absolutely horrible. And so I decided I need to actually emulate and start, you know, standing up for, you know, truth, just like just in the same way that I do the activism and the interventions is the exact same way I decided, you know what, now I need to tell the truth and I need to get a higher platform out there and I need to actually challenge the warmongers.
So you have mentioned the Bronx. This is where you grew up. So tell us a little bit about your upbringing there, because, I mean, you have published some history of the last, well, of your lifetime there.
Yeah, there's a documentary that my friends at Dude Dissidents made, and I'm really happy about that documentary. You know, growing up here in the Bronx, I mean, you're surrounded by poverty, you're surrounded by crime. Yes, you know, there's drug addicts everywhere. It's not just the Bronx, of course. I mean, the entire city has essentially collapsed and fallen apart. But I think, you know, what I'm trying to do is kind of redefine what it means to be from the Bronx. That's what I'm going for. I want to make sure that when people think of the Bronx, they don't think about the violence. They don't think about the illiteracy or the miseducation. They actually think about what's real. They think about the fact that, like, I want to make an astronomy club here in the Bronx, that I want to actually make something great here in the Bronx where people can be inspired. Or have a space center. You know, I want people advocating for a space center. I have no illusion that I'm going to win. I have no illusion that I'm going to get votes, but I'm going to do what I can.
So what do you expect from the election? What kind of response are you getting, and what kind of result do you expect?
Well, I don't know if we're going to be on YouTube or not, but can I talk about electric frogs?
Oh, you go for it, but we are not going to be on YouTube. I can promise you that.
Okay. Election fraud is what I was trying to say. Diane and I met with a state legislator who I won't say his name, but somebody who was pretty in a senior position who said to me, you know, Jose, you should have ran as a Democrat. You know, you might have had a bigger platform and a bigger visibility. And I said, do you honestly think I would have been allowed to win and given an honest vote? And he said to me, yeah, I mean, I was there the night, you know, and he wouldn't tell me the year, but he said, you know, pretty recently when the Board of Elections took all the voting machines after the polls closed, took them into a building, locked the building, and then just started switching the votes around. And I was like, what? And he just straight up told me that they just started switching votes around. And I said, you need to come out publicly. And he wouldn't do it. And he said, it'll be in my book when I publish it. It'll be in my book. And I was just like, what? So, you know, the kind of result I expect is one that they need to give me in order to humiliate me, right? Something like 1-2% of the vote. I don't know. You know, something to make it seem like they have to make sure that there cannot be any legitimate kind of resistance or opposition to the status quo that already exists. So they're going to try and stomp me out in the ballot box. And you know, the kind of response we've been getting has been a national response so far, apart from the people here in the Bronx, right? I get tons of support in the Bronx. People can go on my social media at JOSBTRIGGA. That's my Twitter and Instagram and stuff. And don't ask me about the name, but I have videos of people who like come into where I work. Because, you know, I work in the Bronx. People know where I work, which is where I am now. and they come in here and then they want to take pictures with me or videos with me endorsing me. And then I have the national response, which is that when people donate or they sign up to my website, I call them to personally thank them for supporting my campaign. And these are people like Florida, Connecticut, these are people in California, Kentucky, Iowa, like the entire nation, you know, is basically saying like, yeah, we got your back. We support you. We want to see you succeed in the Bronx. And so I can't thank people enough for their outpouring of support. It has moved me to tears many times. And now that the crying has to stop and the action has to keep going. So, yeah.
Okay. So when I look at you and I listen to you, you're coming across as a very optimistic, enthusiastic, motivated individual, and in the face of utter pessimism. So, you know, I can think of many, many people that would take the attitude of, well, you know, the voting is rigged. What the hell's the point? Let's not bother. How do you motivate yourself? And what do you say to people that take this pessimist point of view?
You know, it's not easy. I mean, I can tell you that. I think I understand pessimism. I understand why somebody would think that, you know, voting is useless and why there's no reason to do it. Because like I said, I mean, I just laid out to you the fraud and I told it to you with a smile on my face, right? It's like, oh, yeah, by the way, they're going to stomp me out of the ballot box. First of all, I think you have to laugh at it. You just have to laugh at the absurdity of it because the alternative is crying about it, right? And, you know, it's better to laugh than cry. I think what kind of keeps me motivated is the fact that, you know, my association with the Schiller Institute for the last 10 years of my life, I'm 25, I've been around since I was about 15 years old. You know, it's always been this emphasis on culture, classical culture. And I think, you know, I really draw from those sources and those wells of Shakespeare, of Edgar Poe, who, you know, has his cottage here in the Bronx, and also people like Beethoven and Mozart and Bach, you know. I believe that all art is inherently political, but also it's inherently optimistic about people, that people will always overcome and can surmount any obstacle that seems impossible, you know. And I think ultimately the ultimate driver of what drives me is just love. It's just love and empathy for mankind, you know. I'm a believer in the poem, you know. No man is an island. Every man's death diminishes me because I am a part of mankind. Yeah, of course. You know, so ask not for whom the bell tolls, for it tolls for thee. I mean, if that is the case, and I have to be optimistic because people are relying on me and looking up to me and hoping that I can do something for the country. And then I look at them and I say, now you have to do something too. You know, it can't just be me. I understand there's a lot of people who want to see me succeed, maybe want to see me win. I just don't know if that's possible. But what we can do with the campaign is inspire other people to actually stand up and do what I've done. And I'm hope that my optimism is contagious enough that it will make others act too in the name of mankind. You know, I don't think I'll see in my lifetime a change or a success, but what we will see, hopefully, is other people acting. And if we start acting now, the future will be defined by what we do now.
What is your view of the world at the moment? And where do you see the opportunities?
Oh, well, as Lyndon LaRouche used to say, you know, things aren't as bad as you think they are. They are far worse. And I think that's kind of the world I see it right now. You know, I have to bring this up, you know, the guy who committed self-immolation yesterday, you know, a guy burned himself alive, I think in front of an Israeli embassy. He, you know, I think his last words were something like, I'm about to commit an extreme act of protest, but nothing as extreme as what the people of Palestine are going through. And honestly, it really does break my heart that this young man, 25 years old, right? The fact that this guy is the same age as me, and I'm deciding to run for Congress, and he decides to burn himself alive as a way to protest what's going on. He is a serviceman. He, by the very virtue of being in the military, has decided that his life, the meaning of his life, will be to protect and serve his country and serve its best interests. And he has now felt that there is no recourse from the genocide that the United States and Israel is actively committing, and he did not want to be a pawn to it. He did not want to take orders. I think there was something that Max Blumenthal shared this recently that the Air Force was giving orders that, you know, the Air Force is supposed to help in the air space in Israel or something. And so this soldier's like, I'm not doing that. And he decided to burn himself alive. I mean, that is an extreme act of protest, as he said. And my heart just breaks about the fact that he felt as if he had to do that. And I think our responsibility right now for us that are living has to be to provide a living alternative to the problems and the pessimism of the world. And my heart breaks for him. We will mourn him and his family. And I don't want to let his death go in vain. And I look at it and it's like, my job is to make sure that nobody else has to burn themselves alive to get a message out there and tell the truth about what's going on.
Why are there so few willing to take the stand that you're taking?
I mean, maybe during the Ukraine, when Ukraine and Russia, when that war first broke out, it was definitely like standing up against that status quo, because people didn't really, like, the general population didn't really understand, like, the yes, you know, oh, Putin is this authoritarian dictator. And to stand up against that, yeah, that was kind of scary, but people still did it. But now what you're seeing is, like, every week there's like a new intervention. Like, Kamala Harris can't step outside without getting yelled at, or Biden, or the media, or even people in Lockheed Martin. Like, I saw there was this thing where Lockheed Martin was speaking at a university, some recruiters for Lockheed Martin, they were speaking at a university. And then the people asking questions were like, how many of your missiles are being used to kill children in Gaza right now? You know, like, and I was just like, yeah, yeah. And that went viral. And so, and then there was this thing in Berlin at the Cinema of Peace, I think that's the name of it, right, where Hillary Clinton was heckled. And there were like 5-6 people all stood up in that same style that I did against other people, where they were just like denouncing her. They were delivering this righteous fury and justice to her. Like, these are happening almost every day. And that makes me optimistic, because it's creating attention around the world, right? The fact that that happened in Berlin, and the fact that you have the Hillary Clinton heckling happening here in the United States and in Berlin. Yeah, no, we are on the cusp, as bad as things look right now, to completely overturn the chessboard and take over and create a virtuous world where the truth tellers are the ones in power and the liars are where Julian Assange is right now.
What would that world look like?
Oh, where people told the truth and the liars go into jail?
No, I mean, this, the virtuous world that you're talking about, how do you see that being?
Oh, I see that being a world where people can actually respect each other's sovereignty, where countries don't have to step on each other and feel as if they have to, you know, put their imperialist boot on their necks and tell them what to do. The first thing would be dismantling 200 and something military bases that the United States has around the world, and bringing the war criminals to justice. It would be a world where a Rishi Sunak or a Boris Johnson would have never come close to being in power. And it would be a world in which people can look and say, like, why the hell did we elect Joe Biden, who keeps falling asleep at the wheel every 10 seconds? And we would have presidential candidates who are not incompetent. And I think not only that, but it would be a world of development. It would be a world where there would be no poverty, where poverty would be something that's studied in history books. And it would be a world in which there's just development always. And it would be something where young men and women can, you know, expand their creative potential, put out missions into, you know, space, and create advanced medical research that creates cures for things that people don't think there can be a cure for, like AIDS or cancer. I mean, it's just, it would be a complete orientation shift between a $1 trillion defense budget to a $1 trillion national development budget. What could the country do with $1 trillion of addressing homelessness, of addressing the underdevelopment, of addressing our terrible infrastructure? It would just be a complete total 180 shift.
Do you think that idea of the world is represented by what the Global South is building at the moment?
Yes, absolutely. The BRICS is that's the alternative, you know? Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa plus. Now, they got like 23 countries now that are officially part of BRICS. You know, they are saying We want a multipolar world, not this stupid unipolar rules-based order world. And so they are offering a complete alternative and rejection to the imperialist ways. And before the BRICS, there was the non-aligned movement. And I think even Malcolm X had spoken one of these things and had supported the non-aligned movement. So I completely agree. The Global South is kind of like taking the first steps towards that. As a U.S. congressman, as somebody who is running for office, I would call for the United States to join the BRICS. You know, the Chinese have invited every presidential administration since the launching in 2013 to join, have invited the United States to join the BRICS. You know, they invited Obama, they invited Trump, and they invited Biden, and we keep saying no. I think we should absolutely join the BRICS movement, and I think we should turn over a new leaf of imperialism and one that looks favorably towards mutual sovereignty and mutual development and mutual economic cooperation.
So again, in this area, you know, I see a lot of pessimism out there. So I see a lot of people arguing that, well, what Xi and Putin are doing is just the other side of the same coin. They're pushing central bank digital currency. They're pushing digital ID. They're pushing technocracy. It's really the same thing in another guise. I mean, what would your response be to that?
There's a few different examples I can find of the sovereignty of where China and Russia do respect sovereignty in different countries. For example, China has outlawed Bitcoin, and I think cryptocurrency as a whole. I think all of cryptocurrency, but I know they've outlawed Bitcoin. Then one of their main allies that they are giving a lot of money for development for is El Salvador. So, you know, that's where my roots are. You know, my parents are both Salvadorian. I was born in the Bronx, but in El Salvador, they give El Salvador, you know, money to help them build highways and infrastructure. And I think recently they just unveiled their national library, which was helped built with some of the Chinese resources that was given to El Salvador. El Salvador has a currency. Their second official currency is Bitcoin, other than the U.S. dollar. So, you know, and the Chinese still decide to help them, right? It's the same thing with the African nations that the Chinese are helping develop. It's that, you know, the African nations run their governments completely different than how the Chinese would ever run their governments too. But I think the ultimate expression of seeing how this mutual cooperation works, I can't remember which African country it was. I think it was Niger or Nigeria. And their economic minister said, you know, when the Chinese come and they talk of development, they give us power plants, they give us roads, and they give us this and that. When the Americans come, they give us lectures. So I think, you know, that right there goes to kind of address the fear that people may have about it being the other side of the coin. It's like, well, what's actually being produced and what's actually being done by the Chinese and the Russians and Brazil? It's just mutual economic development. And I think the most important is a real respect of sovereignty, because we've seen that. We don't see Chinese soldiers in these countries. We don't see the Chinese or Russians setting up military bases in these countries. We see them sending workers. We see them sending construction workers or, you know, ministers, people to advise these projects. That's what we see. We don't see war and death.
Indeed. But on the other hand, we see in North Africa, for example, or other places, we see Western influence attempting to disrupt what's going on there. So, you know, we've got a wide-ranging insurgency in many North African countries that's been going on for quite a long time, since well before the Chinese or the Russians ever got there, I suspect. But it's certainly something that we tend to see the fingers of the British or the Europeans, and certainly the European Union considers the Sahel to be its territory and is really very concerned about Russia and China's influence there. Is the development that's happening there as a result of BRICS enough to overcome the influence from Western governments that promotes insurgency?
No, it's not enough. It's a good start, but it is not enough, because the West, if it continues to exist in the modus operandi that it does right now, is always going to try and do something dirty and sneaky to subterfuge what's actually going on. with the development. I mean, they're actively doing this. You know, I mean, the CIA has toppled governments before. They've murdered people if they needed to. They have no problem doing those things again. What you need is, I don't want the United States to collapse. I don't. But it's heading that way, right? And it's just becoming, it's going to collapse under its own weight. You know, the country's just becoming poorer and poorer, but the richer are getting richer. Yeah, that's obvious. But it's just not a sustainable model that the West has. I mean, we see this with the way in which NATO keeps throwing all this money to Ukraine and they're not getting the results they want and they all look like fools. And all the sanctions they throw at Russia only strengthens Russia, right? So it's falling apart. It's going to collapse. And until that happens, or if there's a complete rescue and a retooling of the United States, right, where I come in and I say, whoa, 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 we are not going to fall. Right? We have to completely like turn everything inside out. We have to retool our military budget and our defense budget. We have to learn how to play friendly with other countries again. And we have to cease all of our espionage operations that are going on around the country that are actively working to overthrow whatever governments are working with the Chinese and Russians right now. Only until that happens will then the BRICS be enough to counteract the Western influence and then move beyond and probably accelerate even faster.
Okay, let's move on to a slightly different topic there then, because of course you're running for Congress, but how much coverage are you getting in the mainstream media? And this is completely rhetorical. I know the answer to this already, but I just want you to tell us. Just tell us for the sake of argument.
Oh, please. I don't even know if they know I'm running, or if they do, they nothing at all. Nothing. You know, I've had to rely on outlets like yours, and Kim Iverson had me on recently. I announced my congressional run on Jimmy Dore's show, right? I announced it on Jimmy Dore, and then I was on Kim Iverson. I was on Two Dissidents. I mean, you know, everybody who's in alternative media right now, not everybody, but people who are in alternative media. What's interesting about this campaign is that, like, it's a real test of potency to see, well, how potent is alternative media, right? You know, we keep saying that alternative media is powerful, that it gets, you know, people like Tucker and Joe Rogan get way more views than, you know, CNN or Fox News or whatever mainstream outlets, right? So we're seeing, will that be true? Is that true? And how can that help influence my campaign and other independent campaigns around the country? Because I'm not the only independent running for Congress. We have a little network. You know, there's somebody down in Florida. There's somebody on the West Coast who's running. They're all independent, all different people. And we're all relying on the same alternative media. So, you know, I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see how does alternative media play a role in this upcoming election. And we'll see what happens.
I think no
mainstream media coverage.
No. Well, and I didn't expect there would be, but at least there. I mean, you know, what you're saying, I presume, is complete silence. So they're not attacking you because they don't want to give you any exposure. I take it that is the case.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, if Richie Torres came out tomorrow and said there's some idiot in my district who thinks he can take me on, I mean, people would just support me just on that basis alone, because like, oh, Richie Torres doesn't like this guy. Well, I like that guy, right? So if he did that, that would be like a dead sentence to him. But so, yeah, no.
Yeah, but coming back to the alternative media question, because that's a very interesting point you make. I think the difficulty that we have as alternative media is that we don't have the infrastructure. So, you know, mainstream media, they have their own printing presses, or they have their own broadcast transmitters or whatever they have. You know, they have this infrastructure. We are reliant on the platforms. Now, in the UK and in the EU in particular, we are now subject to online safety, online harms legislation. In the United States, you're still, to some degree, protected by your constitutional right to free speech. But then we have in the US the so-called Kids Online Safety Act starting to make an appearance and work its way through Congress and the Senate. How restrictive are the platforms to alternative media getting the message out?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you're completely right about that. And I think I'm being, there's something happening with my Twitter account, because every time I get a follower, I lose a follower or something. And so I look at my notifications and I see like, oh, 200 new people followed me today. But then I look at my follower account, it's still the same, right? And, you know, I mean, that's just one specific platform. That's X, or formerly known as Twitter. And I think that's been happening ever since Elon Musk went and visited Israel and hung out with Netanyahu. You know, because my account and other pro-Gaza accounts, pro-Palestine accounts, have been seeing the same kind of, you know, restriction and censorship. So, yes, in one sense, you are restricted, but that's kind of the appeal, because people know mainstream media is bullshit, and they are looking for some kind of underground, like, way of getting their information and their news and staying up to date. Like, people like the appeal that, like, whoa, like, yeah, these guys don't have that infrastructure, and they're probably even being censored on places like YouTube, Meta, and now Twitter. Like, you know, Rumble, thankfully, I mean, I haven't seen any kind of, like, I haven't seen any kind of, not that I know of, any kind of censorship or any kind of, like, way of taking people down on these platforms, on Rumble, but hopefully it stays that way. Hopefully it can continue to be that way on Rumble. But I do think there is this kind of appeal that people have to the alternative media platforms that make your voice louder than you would think possible. Because every time Joe Rogan says something, there's like, what, 5, 6, 7 articles denouncing whatever thing he said, right? And when people see that the mainstream media is reacting that way to something said on alternative media, they're only going to flock more and more to alternative media, because they know, like, okay, there's something that I'm not supposed to know or say. So, yes, I think the fact that we are being censored and silenced and we have to go on alternative platforms in order to get our voice out there, that's our strongest asset. It's like what they call the Streisand effect. I don't know why it's called the Streisand effect, but, like, the more you try to keep something quiet, the louder it becomes and the more it resonates.
Let's come back to the Middle East then, because you're talking about your X account being perceived as a pro-Palestine account. But let's just talk about the Middle East. Just give us your thoughts on what's going on there at the moment and what the potential solutions might be.
Jesus, Mike, you got me speaking like a pundit over here on CNN or something, you know? What's your take on the Middle East? It's like, where do I start? I don't know. All right. Okay. Well, there is, as stated by the International Court of Justice, there is probable cause that the Israelis are committing an act of genocide. And I think, what, like yesterday or so, they were supposed to have their 1 month report as to how they were going to comply with what's going on, how they were going to comply with the rules that the ICJ has put, saying that they have to make sure aid gets delivered and they can't keep killing civilians, which they have not done at all. They have not fulfilled any single one of their promises. I think the situation looks bleak. The situation just looks bleak over in the Middle East. I mean, you know, we're talking about Israel. Israel's just basically having a heyday. Like, no matter how much yelling and screaming people are doing, they just don't seem to care. They don't seem to be relenting at all. And things are bad, Mike, in the Middle East.
right. Okay. But so what I'm getting at, there's a couple of things I'm getting at. The first is that, of course, the reason that they are doing this with impunity and with such confidence is because no matter what Joe Biden might say in public, or Rishi Sunak might say in public, there is an implicit support for everything that they're doing, and that seems to be one point about it. But what I was actually hoping you were going to get to was what the answers might be, what the solutions might be, because I believe you guys have a plan.
This is an alley-oop, a layup. Oh, Mike, I'm sorry. You have to understand, I am an unorthodox candidate. You know, I call it as I see it. You know, I really, yes, the Oasis plan is our, no, yes, we actually do have a solution apart from just a ceasefire. I mean, yes, you need a ceasefire. Absolutely. What comes after is kind of the question that is floating around in people's heads. And I've had an interesting discussion with some of my supporters and followers. One person in particular She came up with this idea of like a Marshall's Plan style reconstruction. Good idea. But what the LaRouche organization and the Schiller Institute have proposed is an OASIS plan. This is what we call the OASIS plan. Mutual development for all parties in the region. This isn't just Israel and Gaza and Palestine. This is Israel, Palestine. This is Lebanon. This is Syria. This is Egypt, right? You need to have clean water in the region. You need to have infrastructure in the region because that is the basis for a sustainable, lasting peace. You know, the failure of the Oslo Accords was not that they happened or that they weren't going to work. It was that you didn't have like shovels in the ground the next day, right? You didn't have development happening the next day, right? So right now it's obvious what needs to happen. 2 million people have been displaced from Gaza, and the population of Gaza is 2 million people. You need immediate reconstruction of the place. You need to rebuild those buildings and probably build them back up stronger. You need to bring in nuclear capabilities just to desalinate water so you can get fresh water in there as quick as possible. And you need aid. You just need to, you know, the way that Gaza is being bombarded with missiles right now is the same way it needs to be bombarded with aid, okay, with health supplies, with food, with water, with supplies. Really begin to rebuild the region, develop it, build rail around the country that connects between all the countries there, build roads, and have people live a sustainable life. Because the problem with just a ceasefire is that it's like being rescued in the middle of the ocean, right? You're drowning in the middle of the ocean, then the National Guard that comes, they rescue you, great. That doesn't guarantee your survival for the next 20 years, though. Right. That doesn't guarantee that you'll live a happy, healthy life just because you were rescued once. You know, the Oslo Accords happened. There was peace. There was optimism. And then Rabin and Arafat were killed, assassinated because of those accords. You need development. You need to completely redevelop all the countries in the Middle East to make sure that there can never be a conflict again. You know, there was something that like there was a narrative I was reading that there's like a 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 year old boy who has never stepped outside of Gaza, who only sees walls and Israeli soldiers. That's his life. What a horrible way to live. That is all that young man sees or that young boy sees is just soldiers, weapons and walls, starvation, famine, abuse and racism every day. That is a horrible way to live. And so a ceasefire does not address that at all, although you need it. Again, I'm not saying we don't need a ceasefire. Absolutely need a ceasefire. And I think this is something that the UN and the International Court of Justice is going to have to really, 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 you know, buckle down and say, yeah, we need to redevelop the region and we need to do something other than just making sure there's no more fighting. Because the way to prevent fighting is development. And that's why I endorsed the OASIS plan. And I think that's the answer to the man who burned himself alive yesterday. You know, he felt as if there's no more recourse and there's no more solution to what's going on. So he just decided to burn himself alive. We have to be the living alternative to that. We have to say, no, there is a solution. No one else has to burn themselves alive anymore. There is a solution for development and lasting peace in the region. And, you know, we should do that in that guy's name because he instead of giving his life to his country that was committing genocide, he gave his life to raise awareness of a cause of a real genocide happening. And, you know, what happened as a result of that is that CNN read out loud his last words, you know, so on mainstream media, they were forced to admit that, yeah, okay, there might be a genocide or this person believed there was a genocide going on. I mean, what does that do to the people who only watch mainstream media? It completely changes them. So now we need to take it a step further and make sure there never has to be a reason for anyone to burn themselves alive anymore.
Okay, so then coming back to New York. New York I've been to New York a number of times. I really liked New York when I was there, but that was quite a long time ago. That was, 25 years ago, something like that. Different place. It has changed a lot in that time. And one of the things that has absolutely happened is that rents have gone through the roof. Now, you're from the Bronx, but in the broader New York, I do wonder how people live there at the moment.
It's another one of like, how do I even begin? I'll give you a very good story. 2022, I'm petitioning for Diane Sayre to get her on the ballot. And I am in Harlem, which is in the middle of New York City. I'm at 125th Street and Lenox Avenue. And there's a Whole Foods there, and the place has become gentrified now. And so there I am in this neighborhood. I'm getting signatures from people, you know, to get Diane on the ballot. And then I see a man, maybe he was like in his early 30s, late 20s. He's folded over, literally like folded over, because he's high on probably fentanyl or something. And then there's a man to his right recording him with his phone. So I'm just watching this unfold. And then the guy finishes recording. The guy comes over to me who's recording on his phone, and he says to me, excuse me, I really don't know how these phones work, but can you help me send this video to my son? Because I want to show him what his brother is up to so he doesn't end up like his brother. And so I was like shocked, right? Because this is, you see this every day. There are people folded over in like every other corner in New York City, in Manhattan. They are like this every day. And so this guy, I help him send the video to his son. He says, thank you. And then he grabs his other son and he says, come on. And the guy was folded over. His head is still down. He's still folded over. His hand is sticking up, you know, and his dad is like basically dragging him home. And they're walking step by step. I could not petition that day anymore. I had to just stop and I just broke down crying because this is the reality for thousands of families that live here in New York City. The high rent, that's just one of many problems. The drug overdoses is another kind of problem. The poverty is a third kind of problem, right? I haven't even talked about immigration yet, not even the influx of immigrants that have come in. New York City was a disaster before the immigrants came in. And now that you have this influx of immigrants, you have no space for them, you have no housing for them, and they are living in like the most squalid of squalid conditions. I don't know why people think that they're living, oh, well, they're in these five-star hotels. Have you actually, like, people, they don't get the service, they don't get the hotel service, you know, they don't get the food. There's like 6, 7, 8 people packed into like a 2-bed hotel room. You know, they're not living rosy lives, you know? So the immigrants are not the problem here in New York City. The problem is that New York City has shut down factories. It shut down its productive centers. They don't care about the infrastructure anymore. You know, ceilings collapse like every other day here in the Bronx. The other day, actually, and I'm working on a report on this, at the beginning of my campaign, there was shit water that came in. I live on the second floor. On the third floor, a toilet overflowed, supposedly a toilet overflowed. And all that water leaked into my apartment. This was in the beginning of my campaign. This was only like 2 weeks ago, 2-3 weeks ago. And the super came and was like, yeah, the best I could do is put some buckets down, I guess. And you're just going to have to ride it out. And then I got sick. I got norovirus from that because apparently it was fecal water. And I was so pissed off. Like, I went on Twitter and I was like recording myself. And then I deleted it afterwards because I got too emotional. But I'm telling this story about what happened to me personally, not because I want sympathy or pity, but because this is the reality of thousands of people who live in the Bronx or Brooklyn or Manhattan or Queens or Staten Island. Like, that is the reality of living in New York City. Okay. This place sucks. And like, you know, it's like, oh, but Jose, you're running for Congress. You can't talk bad about your district. No, I can't, because it's the truth. Okay. The district is horrible. Okay. There's just poverty everywhere. It's all falling apart. But the worst part is nobody gives a shit. None of these politicians actually care about these people like I do. Nobody actually loves these people. Okay. They just get them for a vote. They get them for donations. And then they say, see, screw you. You know, it's horrible. It's horrible. I'm fed up with it and I'm tired. And that's the reality of living in New York. Sorry if I went off there.
No, that's absolutely fine. Because, you know, many people that live in London would probably have some sympathy with that. I don't think London's anywhere near as bad, but I've been quite shocked about the way that New York has gone in the last 20-25 years. You're standing for Congress. When is that? When is the actual vote? Is that going to be in November alongside the presidential vote, or is there some other election day?
Certainly. I believe election day is November 6th or so. It's usually on a Tuesday. November 5th. Yep, November 5th. It's on my friend's birthday. Yeah, November 5th. It's the same thing as the presidential, right? So when people go vote for, you know, either a shot of poison or a gunshot to the head or a snake bite, they can also vote for me too. So
Right. Yeah. Okay. So you've got 6 or 7 months or whatever that is. So what's the plan for the next period? How are you going to ramp this campaign up?
Okay. So yeah, I mean, apart from the national coverage and now international coverage, because you're from the UK and UK column, but we started a campaign, which is that like my opponent has what, $4 million in his chest right now, which you can roll over money from previous campaigns. He's completely funded by special interest groups like IPAC, the American Israeli Political Action Committee, that has donated $500,000 to his campaign. I'm out resourced, but at the same time, we have a tool, which is that me being from here and having studied the principles of street art, we are starting an initiative where we are going to poster and plaster stickers and signage everywhere in the Bronx. Now, I don't even care if it's in the district or not, in the Bronx. This is a Bronx campaign. I'm currently somewhere not in my district in the Bronx, but I'm on the line of it. And the entire Bronx needs to be inundated, flooded. Every McDonald's bathroom, every bar bathroom has to have a sticker on it that says the truth defies silence. And then it's this great poster. I guess if this is a recording, I'll send the image that you can put it over here now. But it's this image of me being dragged out of could you get me one of my flyers that's by the door? Yeah, sorry. One of my boss is about to get one of my flyers here. We're professional here, by the way. You know, as you can tell, this is like a highbrow campaign. Thank you. This one here. So the truth defies silence, vote Jose Vega. And then it's this wonderful image that one of my supporters made. And we have stickers of this. We've started putting them up in lampposts, bathrooms, and we're just going to do that between now and April, because then petitioning starts, and I need to get 3,500 signatures at minimum, 3,500 valid signatures, which means minimally 7,000, ideally 10,500 signatures. That's what we need to get in order for me to actually be on the ballot, so that people actually can vote for me. This image has to be everywhere, flooded in the Bronx. That's
right. And I mean, some people may say that that's a pretty tall order, but you know, a similar effort was done for Diane to run for Senate, and she succeeded despite all the roadblocks that were being put in her
exactly.
way last year. So you should be able to do that, or at least I hope you're able to do that.
Oh, well, we'll see. I mean, if someone shoots me, then maybe it'll be impossible, but you know, if I'm sorry, now I'm getting too loosey-goosey here. Now you've you've unleashed me. Like, you provoked me. I should probably calm down a bit. And also the great thing about the petitioning is that because Diane's running again, of course, she's running against Kirsten Gillibrand. Hopefully my signatures will be able to pull together, will count towards her total too, because we're both running on the same LaRouche line. So we're still working that out. But basically, like, if I were to get 10,000 signatures, that will hopefully count towards her pool of what she needs, which is another 90,000 signatures. So, yeah.
So what, she needs 100,000 signatures in total?
Well, last time she needed 45,000 signatures and we ended up with like 69,000 signatures. And that was because we were able to get away with that because we had excellent clerking. Like, in other words, like, we were throwing signatures out that weren't valid. Like, we didn't want to give anybody a reason to think that our signatures weren't valid, because we were self-clerking. Like, we were thinking, like, what if somebody were to challenge each of these signatures? Would they be valid? That's what we were doing. And now we suspect they're gonna throw everything at us. So we need to make sure that not only do we far exceed double 90,000, we want to go for probably triple, you know, 130,000 signatures. If we can do that, and, you know, really establish our presence in New York, but also give a message to the establishment. We're not here to play. We're here to actually get something going, get something done. Yeah. Then, yeah. No.
If you're needing 10,000 signatures and you're looking for 130 for her, what's the size of the district? So give me an idea of what sort of scale, you know, what proportion of people you need to encourage to sign.
Yeah, the Bronx itself is a 6.8 square miles. It's a tiny borough, and there are about 800,000 voters here.
Right.
Just in the Bronx alone. Diane can get signatures anywhere in the state, in all of New York State. But, you know, and so I only need 10,000 people to sign, who are voters, who are eligible voters, to sign my petition in the Bronx. She, and then those same 10,000 people can also sign for her because, you know, they're eligible voters.
So, would you expect those 10,000 people then to vote for you, or is that not a requirement?
No, that's not a requirement. It's not a requirement. Like, we last year we had people like who are Chuck Schumer supporters, and they would come up to our, you know, see that we were running against Chuck Schumer, and they would see we were running against Chuck Schumer, and they'd say, whoa, I support Chuck Schumer. And we would say, hey, you don't have to vote for us, but don't you think he deserves a challenge? And they're like, okay, all right, I'll sign your ballot. Sure.
Okay.
And, you know, democracy, right? So other Chuck Schumer supporters were not so so friendly. They were like, you should not be on the ballot. You're crazy. You're kooky. How dare you think you could go against Chuck? But some of them were a little more reasonable.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, look, Jose, I'm going to say, let's leave it there for now. We started off with the video clip. Let's end with a question about that video clip. When you were dragged out of the hole, what did they actually do to you that day?
That day, that was the one that took, because the guy, first of all, I was dropped to the ground, and then I was bear hugged by the dean of Columbia School of Journalism. I was bear hugged and I was dragged by the Columbia Dean School of Journalism, which I found out later is illegal because he's not supposed to put his hands on me. And then I was bear hugged out. I was taken down the elevator, and then I was just told, get the hell out of here right now before we call the police. If they called the police, I wasn't going to care, but I left. You know, that's it. I just left. And, you know, that's ultimately like, that's the big fear that people have. It's like, what's going to happen to me after I intervene? Not a lot, actually. I mean, at least in New York City. I can only speak from my experiences. I've never been arrested. I've never been put in handcuffs. I've been, quote unquote, detained once, but they didn't even bother putting handcuffs on me, and they let me go immediately after I said I was just practicing my right to free speech. And that's it. You don't have to give your ID. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to tell them anything. You just say, I'm practicing my right for free speech. Let me go. Let me go. And as long as you didn't do anything stupid, like be violent or something, you're free to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, look, Jose, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.